evening, you're listening to The Ride, and I'm your host today, John Wordsworth. Today we'll be talking about some of our favourite board games, and I'm joined here this evening with both Chris Ford and Ben Dodson from the UK. Chris, how are things with you?
Rather marvellous, thank you, John. How are things with you?
Not bad at all, thank you. I am healthy and well again.
And you, Ben? I realised that.
You go on, Chris. It's all right. I don't mind waiting.
No, it's okay. It doesn't matter. I was just going to say that, you know, John said it, good evening, but I usually listen to this when I'm driving to work.
You are our main listener, so yeah. I suppose we should tailor it to you.
Yeah. I'll start the next one. Good morning. Yeah.
Can you please do the entire thing as if you were actually talking to me in the future? Because that's basically how it's going to be.
Good morning, Chris, and today I'm going to tell you about your favourite board game.
Yep.
Watch out for that pedestrian.
Yeah. I ruined the flow. I apologise.
That's all right. To answer your question, I'm better. I too was ill this last week. I couldn't walk for most of it, and today I have become mobile again, so that's been nice. So yeah, I'm good.
You've had pretty rough.
It's been pretty bad. Had a gout in my ankle.
Very bad. Man.
Ooh, nasty. Yeah.
And I ordered a walking stick on like Thursday to come Friday, Amazon Prime, and it didn't turn up till today because they lost it. And it's like, well, I can walk now. And on the packaging, it says, putting the fun in functional. And I was like, that's not right.
I saw on Twitter that you had a walking stick, and I wondered if maybe you like.
You just assumed I'd gone mad.
I assumed that maybe that you were just being eccentric, actually. That was my thought.
I love that that's your first thought. I did really want like a Lucius Malfoy style cane with a wand sort of embedded in it, and then maybe some sort of Bluetooth adapter so that I could, you know, connect it to the internet stuff, but
you see, I just assumed when I saw walking stick that it had either a sword in it or a secret compartment for whiskey.
Again, that does sound like me, and that's probably why I have gout in my ankle. But anyway, yes, I'm good, thank you.
Brilliant. So we'll kick off with some follow-up from the last show. I've got a couple of pieces of news to talk about. First off, we discussed this on the last show about Error 53, this dilemma with the Apple phones where taking your phone to an unauthorized retailer would end up with it being, I'm going to put quotes around it even though you can't see them, bricked. Because the update since the last show is that Apple have now released an update to get around the error. And it is pretty much exactly what Ben suggested they would do, which is they've made it so your phone works again, but if you've had the touch sensor replaced, then it won't let you use that anymore.
Thanks, Tim, for listening in, and I enjoyed our phone call afterwards. That was great. The interesting thing about
makes it makes the most sense as well.
Yeah, it does. The interesting thing about it, which we didn't mention last week because I don't think we realised, is also that it was completely blown out of proportion because it only affected people that upgraded to iOS 9 by plugging in their phone into iTunes. Like, it didn't affect it if you did it over the air, like most sane people. It only affected people who upgraded via iTunes tethering their phone. So, probably three people. But, you know, how the internet loves to argue. Well, you're one of those people.
And don't they recommend that you upgrade your phone using iTunes?
No. Not since, like, iOS 6.
It's because it's, like, a phenomenally large file.
Only when it went from 7 to 8. 7 to 8 they did, because people had no space, but not nowadays. They fixed all that.
It's only large on your internet connection, Chris.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'm going to always update through iTunes. That's how I roll.
Whether it'll brick my phone or not, screw you.
Yeah, it won't brick my phone, because I haven't even got a Touch ID sensor in my
That's why your Bluetooth's broken.
Yeah, it's true. But probably. But don't get me started on that. So this is the follow up every week, isn't it? My Bluetooth still doesn't work properly.
The JJ Abrams of Bluetooth.
I knew that name was soon after.
I haven't mentioned him at all in the last couple of episodes.
No, it has been Ben. Ben just can't let it go.
I can't resist.
So if you want to know what we're talking about, please feel free to go into iTunes and see episode, I don't know, because my Google Docs is 1 through 7, yeah.
Episode 4 was the Star Wars one.
Was it really that long ago?
A long time ago. Wow. We've done a lot of shows. This is pretty cool. So yeah, I think that's a good solution from Apple, and it sounded like it wasn't necessarily even intentional, because they said that it was kind of left over from when factory resets happened, and it's not really intended to brick a live phone. So I mean, at least they've done right anyway. They've put the thing right. So next up, I was just going to do a little update on one of my favorite games of late, which is XCOM 2. I think I'm probably about halfway through the campaign now. It's kind of hard to tell because the game doesn't have a definitive timeline, but I'm starting to unlock some cool technology, which is making me feel a little bit less vulnerable when I go into the tactical matches now. Although, as with any game like this, the more power you get, the more power they get. But still, you start to feel badass regardless. It's good. I don't want to go too much into it because it's just a follow-up. But I think I'm starting to appreciate the strategic layer a bit more now. It's starting to make a little bit of sense.
I need to download it. I've still not tried it because I originally thought it was going to be one of those games that shit me up with stuff jumping out at me. So I completely discounted it whenever you mentioned it. And that was purely based on the artwork for it on Steam. I was like, nope, not for me. Since you mentioned it, it's like, oh, no, it's a nice like real-time strategy. It's like, oh, okay, I should probably get that. So it's on my list of games to play.
It's nice. It's got a bit more in-depth kind of strategy layer between the battles. I don't know how much of it actually matters, but it feels like it does. You know, like I'm not sure if it's a bit like a Telltale game where it doesn't really matter what you do, you end up in the same place. But then the battles, the sort of tactical combat is just feels, for me at least, like improved over the first. There's more to do. They've made a few improvements, so you don't feel quite so cheated. And yeah, it's good. And it's got a multiplayer mode. I think it's just like you pick an army and do 1v1 skirmishes and things, but you know, something that could be entertaining. But that's me, Rue. That's just a quick update from XCOM. I'm sure there'll be one more when I finish it.
Never. So I had a couple bits just from last week, because we had the Kickstarter podcast last week, and I have funded two, despite my fact that I said I would never fund video games on Kickstarter, I have funded two this week.
Nice.
Probably the gout did that to me. I was like, I can't move. I'm enjoying these small games on Steam. Right, I know, I'll buy some more. So the first one is a game called A Place for the Unwilling, and I'll put links for these in the show notes. It's a really nice looking adventure game. They say it's an open world inspired by Majora's Mask and Sunless Sea. And from the little sort of preview I saw of it, it looks really nice. It's kind of got a Machinarium look about it in that it's sort of all hand-drawn. Looks really nice. And they're halfway to their goal in the first 9 days. They only want 20,000 euros. They've got almost 11,000, so that should complete, I think. So check that out. And then, funny enough, they posted an update, and at the bottom of it, they recommend some of the games that they like on Kickstarter. And so I found another one called Pinstripe, An Adventure Through Hell, which is a bizarre and beautiful 2D adventure about a minister in hell made by a one-man team. And this is, like, it's incredible. I watched the video, and it's the best pitch video I've ever seen. It's basically one guy who's incredibly humble and seems really nice, and he's done all of the development, artwork, music, everything, all himself, and he's not hiring any more developers or anything like that. He's still doing it all himself with the money he gets, and he reckons it's going to be finished by, I think it's like August or something this year, because it's practically done. He just wants to not have to freelance for the next 6 months just to finish it off. It's cool. Incredible. It's a real testament to what you can do with one person. Sort of the complete opposite of most Kickstarters where they get funded, they try and make too much, and then they fail. Really, really interesting. So check that one out as well.
And so, I see they've already made over $60,000. So they are.
Yeah, he's already hit his goal. And the funny thing is he's not adding anything extra. That's the great bit about it. It's like, The $60,000meant he got voice acting, was like his stretch goal. And he's got one for $75,000 where he'll add a mobile version, but that'll be released after the Steam version and won't be included in any of the rewards. It's just literally,
really interesting.
And I will make that. But that's definitely one people. You won't get it.
That's highly recommended. Looks like a colourful Limbo.
Yeah, exactly.
Visual stuff. But it looks really good.
The video is really good. I'd thoroughly recommend everyone watch the video at least, just because it's really nicely put together and shows a lot about the guy as well, which I find the more interesting part of it, to be honest. I mean, the game looks great, but I really like the story behind it.
Cool. So that's Pinstripe on Kickstarter.
Great. Well, obviously, also last week on our last episode on Kickstarter, we were talking about Cage Match. The world's first.
I tell you what, Cage Match has caused
Nicolas
problems.
Cage-based dating website.
I mentioned it to
I'm sorry to say that doesn't appear to have gained any more backing since we recorded our last episode. It's a shame. They are fairly heavily under target, I think, with about just over 5% funded. And yet... That still means that they've managed to get over £1,100.
That's because one person bought the £1,000 package, presumably on the basis that it isn't going to fund.
Yes.
I think.
That's very true, actually. Like that. Yes, there is a £1,000 backer. You're absolutely right.
Funnily enough, I started watching more Nicolas Cage films purely based on that. So it's got me back into Nicolas Cage. We watched The Rock at the weekend. And we've got Gone in 60 Seconds, Face Off, and then The Sorcerer's Apprentice downloaded and ready to go.
Oh,
love some Nicolas Cage films. Doesn't he?
Do you know?
It really struck me. He sounds like Ross from Friends, but he looks like Wolowitz from Big Bang Theory.
He's like Nicolas Cage?
Yeah, he's an unholy love child of David Schwimmer and the guy that plays Wolowitz, whose name eludes me right now.
Interesting theory.
Yep.
We'll see how this theory pans out as we have a chance to mull over it. The person who pledged £1,000, do you know what they get as their reward?
I can't remember now.
It's the guy who wants to set up the website will personally come and visit and bring his copy of Con Air on DVD and they can watch it together.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, does sound amazing. So actually, yeah, they've got 24 backers totaling £171 and one nutter with £1,000. So it's almost a shame that this website won't be made, because I've been telling everyone about it. I think it sounds superb, but not that I'm going to waste my money on it.
You just want to see it exist, that's all.
I just want to see it exist, so that I can be happy to know that it's there. There is also another piece of follow-up from our last episode. I went to see Deadpool at the weekend. Mm-hmm. Not even at the weekend. It was last week. I saw it on, like, possibly even opening day. Have either of you seen it?
Not yet, no. I really want to, but I haven't.
Yeah, I also want to see it, but I haven't.
It was brilliant. It was really good. Like, there's so much controversy, or rather not even controversy, when the trailer came out, it really split the audience. I saw the trailer and I thought it looked absolutely superb, as it turned out that it was, but there was an awful lot of hatred out there for the trailer, saying it looks rubbish, it looks like a cash in, blah blah blah, this, that.
Who would have thought there'd be hatred on the internet?
Well, quite, but people were quite vocal about it. It was really good, poked fun at itself an awful lot. Like even in the opening credits scene, like it shows inside Deadpool's wallet, and there's a picture of Green Lantern in there, which was hilarious. it's a lot of fun. The only thing I didn't like about it that much was Colossus from the X-Men. I thought he was very boring, and that's interesting because it was a much more accurate portrayal of Colossus from the comics than they've ever done in the movies before. In fact, I would say that it was absolutely perfect, and yet it was an incredibly dull character. So that says a lot about Colossus, I guess.
I've never really been that drawn to Colossus. He's just the big metal Russian there,
I suppose. I mean, yeah. The other character was the Negasonic Teenage Warhead, which was basically just a grumpy teenage girl who could explode, which was quite funny as well. Yeah, no, it was good. Definitely go and see it. Highly recommend.
Just one question. Yeah. What was the... My main concern with it is that it was going to kind of break the fourth wall a bit too often.
It does. It's, you know, there's a great line.
Does it work? Where,
yes, it works really well. Like, Deadpool goes to the X-Men mansion and, like, Colossus says, oh, go on, we'll go and see the professor. And he just says, oh, is that Stewart or McAvoy? Yeah, works really well. And he goes, it's funny, this mansion's so big, and yet I only ever see two X-Men. It's almost like the studio couldn't afford any more. It was really good. It works really, really, really well. Yeah, awesome. Very good. Definitely recommend.
I do have one more bit of follow-up. I know I didn't put it in the list.
Follow it.
And it's from this show. The Star Wars show was episode 5.
Ah! Good research. Okay. I approve.
Yeah, good. Yep. Good.
Cool.
It's so, not research, it's checking the facts, isn't it?
Yeah. Follow-up fact-checking.
Yeah. I like it. So let's move on to some cool news. Ben, I see you have a piece of cool news on the list.
There's a new game coming out. As we record, it's tomorrow, so by the time this show goes out, it will be available. It's called Super Hot. Now, this was developed at like a 7-day first-person shooter hackathon like 3 or 4 years ago, I believe. And it got put on, I think, Steam Greenlight and then Kickstarter, and now it's finally ready to go. And it's a really interesting idea. It's a very... sort of artsy first-person shooter. I mean, everything's sort of white, and then you've got a few people in red, basically. But time only progresses when you move. So if you, like, shoot at someone, then nothing will happen until you start walking, and then time will progress as much as you move. And so you go through it, and I saw a video of the endless mode of it yesterday, where you basically... You perform like all of these actions in like slow motion, essentially, because you aim at someone, shoot, and then as you move, there's other people moving in around you, kind of like the Weeping Angels in Doctor Who, and that people will creep up on you just because you haven't seen them yet, because it's not movement happening in real time, so you can't hear them or anything. And then when you finally die, you get playback of everything you did, but in real time. So you just look like a total badass because you're like just turning around and hitting things without even looking, really, because, of course, you've had loads of time to look around and shoot at stuff. Looks really interesting. I don't know how much it costs, and I don't know how good it'll be as sort of like a full game. I'm assuming it's going to be around like a $15 kind of price point, I'm guessing, because I think it's probably going to be one of those things you play a few times and go, well, that's a really cool concept, but not anything much more than that. But it's definitely on my wish list, so probably worth checking out.
Yeah,
it looks interesting. The graphics are odd.
Yeah, it's very artsy.
Yeah.
It looks a little bit like 90s virtual reality.
Yeah.
Like you said, about 2 years ago, they put a version up on their website. I think it was just like the whatever fallout from the hackathon where they had a flash version on the website. And it's really fun, but like you say, I'm not sure... It will probably be one of those novelty things where you buy it and play it for a few hours and go, that's cool, and that's it.
It seems to have like a nice editing mode. Like when you finish, you can like edit in real time the video of your previous run and stuff and then upload it directly from the app, which looks quite nice. But again, it's probably limited, really. But could be fun.
Yeah.
And the other piece of cool news I had, also computer game related, is that the HTC Vive, the other 3D headset, because we've obviously got the Oculus Rift, which we discussed a few shows back, and then the Sony one's coming out soon. But the HTC Vive was finally announced with a release date of April, a price of $800, putting it $200 above the Rift. But it does have virtual reality controllers, so the Rift just comes with an Xbox One controller. And while they do have some fancy controllers built just for VR, they're not ready or included. The HTC Vive has those. It'll be interesting to see. Again, I think the price is probably very high for most people, and then obviously you're going to need a very good computer to power it. Allegedly, from the reviews I've seen, the Vive has better field of vision. Although it's the same resolution, it's a bit more, the screen bends a bit more, and you don't have black sort of plastic at the sides.
Yeah.
But it's not as comfortable. It's much heavier than the Rift, and it doesn't have audio built into it either, so it's substantially heavier for less. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out when it actually goes on sale. But interesting nonetheless.
I would really like to try it out, but again, $800, I think.
That's not trying out price. That's...
No. I need to know that I'm going to, even at the Oculus Rift price, I need to know that I'm going to actually use this thing. Yeah. I don't mind paying that if I end up using it, but if I pay that, play one evening of Elite and go, that's cool, put it on the shelf and never touch it, that's not a good use of $600.
No. I'm very tempted with one because I can plug it into my Parrot Bebop drone, and then you can do, as you fly the drone around, you can pretend you're flying. And I said said to my wife earlier, I really want to get that controller so I can do it. And she's like, you sound so stupid saying VR goggles. It's not flying if it's VR goggles. I was like, don't try and limit a man's want to fly. And she's like, it's not flying. It's VR goggles.
You just it is flying. It is flying, man.
It's flying. It's flying a drone. But yeah. So anyway, that looks cool.
I'm going to still debate and decide which one to get. But yeah, I think one will end up on my desk at some point soon. So,
Are there any more coming, or is this it?
Yeah, there's the Sony one coming, which is more for the PlayStation 4, I believe.
Yeah.
But I'm dubious about that because I don't think the PlayStation 4 has the power to do that. Also, the resolution is much less on the PlayStation 1. It's just 1080p, whereas on the both the Vive and the Oculus Rift, I believe it's 1440p, but slightly wider, I think. I could be wrong. Right. But it's definitely higher than 1080p. So they're lowering the resolution to power it, and I'm dubious, because I just don't think the PlayStation 4 has the... When you think the Oculus Rift needs a $900 PC to power it, and the PS4 is like $300, $350, there's obviously a lot of... the graphics cards in a PC required for an Oculus Rift costs more than the entirety of the PS4. So I don't think graphically it's going to be as good. But I'm happy to be proven wrong.
But I think they'll probably be going for the, let's make one that's cheaper. There's a few more fun games. They're not going to look super realistic like they might do on the PC. Yeah. But they'll be colourful Mario-like experiences in a headset, I think, instead of hyper-realistic ones like you're trying out on the PC.
And I think also there's a large market for watching films in VR because you can basically have a 150-inch screen or whatever in front of you, because obviously you're in virtual reality, so you can have a massive screen on a wall without actually having a projector and all that stuff. And you're not going to need much power to do that, but we'll see.
So we have one more piece of news. I'm assuming that Chris put this on the list, because it's about...
I don't know why you think that.
DC Rebirth. Yeah. No, that's me. DC Comics... I have no idea. They're doing a crossover with Spider-Man and Superman, and they're getting Ben Affleck, and J.J. Abrams is going to direct it, and it's going to be great. Right. It's a complete opposite to the... Marvel, what do they call it? Expanded universe.
Cinematic universe.
There we go. Close.
I'm loving where you're going with that. I think we should do a whole episode where you try and bullshit about comics. I think it'd be brilliant.
Wolverine is made out of adamantite.
Ooh, close.
I know it's adamantium.
Yeah, very good. I kind of don't want to do my news piece now. I prefer Ben's. DC Rebirth is something that has been floating around the internet for a few weeks now, and there's been an awful lot of speculation that DC Comics was going to do yet another reboot. DC Comics, if you're not aware, are quite famous for doing extraordinarily far-reaching, wide-sweeping changes to their continuity. They've done it several times over the last sort of 50 years or plus, where they'll just completely rewrite everything in their history and change it again. Most recently, they did it in 2012, I want to say, where they launched what they called the New 52, where they basically just rewrote or just removed all of their history and said, let's start completely from scratch. which was it was met with mixed response. I actually kind of liked it because it was a good jumping on point. But anyway, so this Rebirth, everyone's been saying that it's going to be yet another reboot, which there's not, I don't know why they would want to do that. But there was an interesting video released by Geoff Johns, who is the, I think he's pretty much in charge of DC, but I think he's like chief creative director or something. But he writes regularly on a lot of their flagship books, like the Justice League. And he's quite famous for basically making the Green Lantern franchise what it is today. And he released a video online where he basically said, first of all, no, it's not going to be a reboot. And actually, they released a teaser image that just said something like, it was just a picture of a, like a stage curtain and a spotlight that said Rebirth. And underneath it said, in brackets, said, it's not a reboot and it never was going to be. And basically, he was talking about there was the comic book that made him sort of as famous as he is in DC world was called Green Lantern Rebirth. And it's where this is where he basically completely rewrote the history of like all of the Green Lantern Corps and brought back Hal Jordan and built up this huge like multi-spectrum army thing that they've got going on. I think he might have done the same with The Flash when they brought back Barry Allen after he'd been dead for about 30 years. but those books were fairly seminal in terms of the comic book history. And anyway, so this Rebirth initiative that they're doing is where they've decided that they're going to look at exactly what made those original Rebirth books so good and what made the series so special afterwards. And they're going to do it to every single one of their ongoing titles. So they're going to have this huge event, which I don't know how long it's going to last. I should imagine it will go on for some time, where they're just going to completely go back to basics on all of their major lines. I think that's going to start with in May as well. So I'm quite interested to see what they're going to do with that.
Sounds quite interesting. Do you know who it's going to start with?
I want to say that I do know, but I think I might have forgotten. I think they're going to... I think they're actually going to start with like an 80-page book just called Rebirth, and I think that is going to kick it off. Cool. And then I think it's going to spread out into all of their other ones. But it looks quite interesting. I quite like, you know, I've been into DC since the New 52, and I'm sort of quite interested in all of this stuff that they do. So, yeah, their event comics have been quite good of late. So, yeah, looking forward to that.
I really enjoy the event comics and the 52.
Yes, I know you do. I know you do. Just that remember, when you see Deadpool, it's a comic book movie.
I have actually read the Deadpool comics, or at least three of them. Yeah.
Goodness me.
Yep. Very good. Because he was a character in Lego Marvel that you could unlock, and I was like, why is he so elusive? What's his story? And so I read three of them, and I was like, I see. Good.
I love the way all your leads come from Lego. You're like,
basically, that's how I know who most of the Batman villains are, because I played Lego Batman.
So I watched Ghostbusters recently because of Lego.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I started rewatching Doctor Who as well because of Lego Dimensions.
Brilliant.
Awesome.
Anyway.
Well, that sounds really cool. But I think it's time to move on to the main topic of the show.
Yes.
Which is going to be an opportunity for us to dig into our favourite board games and probably share some games that the others haven't heard of. So, but I thought we could kick it off just by giving each other a general overview of the sort of games that we like and play. Because I know that we all might have very different tastes when it comes to board games. So would you like to start, Ben?
Sure. I mean, I used to, a long time ago, when I lived in Coventry, I used to go to a gaming group every Monday, which was a lot of fun. We'd just meet up in a pub and then basically have about 3 hours to play various different games. So people would bring games with them, and then you'd basically just sort of like choose what table you wanted to sit at and play all kinds of different stuff. So that way I got to play lots and lots of different stuff. Nowadays, I don't do that because I do things like this podcast with my spare time. But I do tend to play much longer games. So I regularly go over to some friends' houses on a weekend and we'll play a game, which I'm going to mention later on, which takes about 8 or 9 hours to play a single game of it.
That's
a lot of wines.
It certainly is a lot of wine, yeah. Again, ankle gout. So, So yeah, I tend to not play so many small games, but large ones. I mean, generally, if I'm going to play a game when friends and that come over, I generally play video games anyway. But if we're going to play something, it'll be something small like we discussed last week, like Cards Against Humanity or the Exploding Kittens game or Flux, stuff like that. Flux is a good game because you can play that with anyone. Things like that I tend to play more and more these days, but I generally prefer something that I can get my teeth into, a good, you know, 6-7 hours of solid game.
Nice and meaty. I like it. How about you, Chris?
You know, I've only really been into games in the last couple of years since I started watching Tabletop on Geek and Sundry Network. Prior to that, I hadn't really played a proper game since like when I was a kid, and maybe used to play Warhammer and the classic family tropes, you know, like Monopoly and such.
And then
I know, I love Monopoly, but I also just despise it. I think is how it. Most people feel.
I loved it until I broke my finger playing Monopoly.
Oh, go on then. You've got to tell that story.
I was cheating. My friend went to the bathroom and we had like a hatch. It'd go through to the kitchen, so he'd see me on the way back. And I snuck under the table and put my hand round to grab some of his money. But I got my finger caught in the table between, like, it was like one of those ones that you can pull out. And it got stuck. And then as I pulled it out, it crack and broke my finger.
Yeah.
And my mum didn't take me to the hospital. She just said, that's what happens to cheaters.
Good lesson.
Good old mum.
Oh dear, dear. And it was it shortly after then that you started hating everything. that's an amazing story. So I can't even work out where my train of thought was going.
Sorry.
Tabletop. So I started watching Tabletop, and it was from there that I started to discover sort of more. I don't know. I can't even really say like modern games, because it's not as if they're only coming out now, but sort of, you know, the last couple of decades worth of good stuff, as opposed to the 100-year-old games like Monopoly and such. Obviously, I'm more interested in family-oriented games, I guess. Stuff that I could play with my wife, stuff that she'd be interested in playing. So there's some things that I see on Tabletop that I think, that looks amazing, and I know instantly that Sophie wouldn't like it, so I know I'll never play it.
Yeah.
I'm just waiting for Alistair to get old enough that we can play something. Probably start him off on Pokemon cards, I would have thought, and then go from there.
Oh, yeah.
Wean him onto the hard stuff.
Yeah, Magic the Gathering.
Yeah. Someone you can finally beat at Magic.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Just joking. Yeah. But that's really cool, though. So, myself, I'm going to skip over RPGs because I think they're their own little beast that deserves
its own episode, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of RPG stuff to talk about. But I guess in terms of card games, just because you finished on that, there's one that we've been playing recently that's really cool called Netrunner, Android Netrunner.
Like the proper old school Netrunner?
Something
from the 80s.
It's a pretty... 90s? I think you might be thinking about, I think it was called Hacker, which is a Steve Jackson game. And right. I guess this has a similar feel, but it's definitely more modern. This is a FFG game, so it's got all the shininess you expect from a FFG-produced game. But it's asymmetrical, which is really nice. So whereas in a game like Magic, you both essentially have similar decks that you're building the same. You're building towards a deck, but it has the same structure. In this game, one person plays the corporation, where you have a completely different sort of deck to the hacker, and then you switch. So you sort of play one round as the defensive corporation and one as the hacker. But that's got a lot of traction in the office, and it's a really nice game that you can just play in maybe sort of 30 minutes for a couple of rounds, so you get to play each faction once.
Nice.
And then you can have something a bit more serious if you've got a few hours to kill, where you know each play each other once, so you can quite easily burn away 3 hours playing this game. But no, I really like it, and it's not collectible like Magic, so you would you know what cards you're getting. a new expansion comes out, right, it has exactly a fixed list of cards. You know what you're buying. There's no random chance. So it's not a money sink. But I guess that's the more sort of, I'm going to say casual, even though it's not a casual game. It's a very, you know, geeky card game. But it's the sort of game that you don't sit down for 8 hours with three bottles of wine like Ben might do.
Three? That's only like only 4 hours. Right. Yeah. In a barrel.
Hence the ankle, I see.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I do like those games that you sit down and play for 6 to 8 hours, but the reality is that time doesn't give me that many chances to play them. So we're normally playing games that are 2 or 3 hours long, but anything from kind of Euro games like Terra Mystica and Carcassonne all the way to, I think I slightly favour the really thematically cool ones, you know, something with a bit of nice artwork on it. So something like Rex or even Dust Tactics, which is a fairly fast-fired miniature-based game set in like futuristic World War III-ish kind of thing. But yeah, I guess any games really I like. So I will play a whole different range of games, but favouring the slightly shorter ones just because of the reality of time. So,
yeah, agreed. I mean, not that I don't like a long game. I seem to remember one New Year when we just played Risk, and we I think it was your copy of Risk, John. You had like Risk 2050 or something, where you had the moon and such.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried doing like a shot after every turn, and like just. Like 4 hours later, everyone's just painfully
See,
sober.
I don't like drinking games because I don't need a game to get me drunk, personally. I can quite happily just drink my own. I find that if we're doing a drinking game, I drink less because I have to wait for something stupid to happen in order to drink. The only time that has not been true was with a game of Top Trumps. And you know the game Top Trumps, where you basically have some cards and it's like, say you're doing, I don't know, films from the DC series, then you might say, okay, Spider-Man versus, Green Lantern, or... did I get those right? Are they DC?
Nope.
Yes! One of them is. One of them, right, okay, good. Then one might have, like, Strength 90 and one has Strength 80, and then, you know, you look at them and go, okay, Strength...
I don't think Spider-Man and Green Lantern are really comparable in strength.
Well, whatever. Everything's comparable in strength and Top Trumps. But you compare it, and then the one that has the lowest score loses. The game I came up with was you have to down a glass of red wine every time you lose a card. Which, Top Trumps, you often get a losing streak, because obviously the person with the upper hand generally keeps it because they choose which card goes next. So my friend lost quite considerably with 9 losses before I started losing. And I couldn't understand why he couldn't speak or stand up.
Nice. So
there, if you want to drink a game, Top Trumps. Top Trumps and glasses of wine. That's how you want to do it.
I'll remember that one for when you visit.
Yeah.
Sweet. So, cool. I thought we could each just pick one game and talk about it in a bit more detail. And then maybe I know we've probably got a lot of games we'd like to bring to the table. So we can rattle through some of our second and third places after we've each talked about our, I'm going to say sort of pick instead of favorite game, because it's very hard to pick just one favorite game, but the one you want to talk about. So I see you want to talk about a game called 1861, Ben. This is one I have not heard about.
Oh, 1861 is a beauty. So I was introduced to 1861 through my board game group, where basically the older men would congregate in a separate room and play games like Canal Mania, which is a 4-hour game, long game about canals. And eventually I was invited to someone's house for the weekend to play 1861, The Railways of the Russian Empire. Now, this is a game which will generally take the novice player 8 to 9 hours, which is a considerable amount of time. If you have played it before, you can generally whittle that down to 6 to 7 hours.
The abridged version for 7 hours.
The interesting thing about it is that there is only one piece of luck in the entire game. Like most games, there's a lot of luck because you have random card draws or dice or any other kind of thing. In 1861, there's only one random part, and that is at the very beginning where you choose the order of play. So you'll pick from like however many people are playing. So there's four of you playing. You'll pick four cards that'll say 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you basically move seats so that you're sat in a clockwise motion, and that's it. And that's the order for the first round of bidding. So the aim of 1861, it's obviously, for such a long game, a very complex game, so I'll try and whittle it down as much as I can. But basically, you are running a Russian railway, or a number of railways. And so you have a board which has all of Russia as it was in 1861. And you basically need to create track, which you'll lay on the board with hexagonal tiles. And each player will lay track for their own company. And obviously they'll merge, and then you'll have points and different turns and things. And then you create your own company. And the aim of the game is to have the most personal amount of money. And you do that by investing in stocks and shares in the other players' train companies. So you don't necessarily win by having the best run train company. You quite often win by just investing in people who are playing better than you. There's one guy that we play with who basically will create about three or four companies and then just horribly asset strip them after people have started investing in it, just so he can take all of their money. So it's a fun game, but basically you lay a lot of track, which you can be quite sneaky in how you do that, because you can block certain routes. Like if someone's trying to get into Moscow from what's the place, I can't remember the name of any of the places in Russia now. From Kiev, if you're trying to get from Moscow to Kiev, someone might block you. They might veer off to St. Petersburg or something so that you can't get there. And various turns happen as the ages roll by, which unveil new pieces of track, like with more points or hubs. The stations get upgraded. You get faster trains that can go longer distances. Because a large part of it is that you have to run a train from various stations, and you get money for each station that you go through, that kind of thing. Which gets very difficult later on, because by the end your train can maybe make 8 stops, but there'll be certain stations you can't go through, you can't go back on yourself, so depending on how the track is laid out, you might have severely stunted yourself. And also it's very aggressive in terms of as the ages go through, old trains and things basically get removed by the state. And if that happens, then your company just gets bankrupted and bought out. And then you've got this whole stock market mechanism, which is very complicated. And then you've got the Russian state railway starts up in, I think, the fourth round of the game, which basically competes with you. So you slowly get nationalized as well. It's an interesting game. One of the nice things about it is that you start off so small. At the beginning, you're literally investing in little private railways, and then you start building a little minor company, and then you start trading as a public company with shares and stocks. And you can choose from a number of different company names. I always like the Grand Russian. It's a really interesting game, because it's got a lot of phases to it. It's not just 8 hours of the same game. You've basically got the very, very beginning, where it's all, you know, getting investment, starting stuff out. Then there's a whole track laying part to it, and then you get into a more game-like stock market series of rounds. And as I say, there's practically no luck involved at all. There's literally just choosing the order of bidding for the minor companies at the beginning, which doesn't really have that much bearing on the rest of the game. So it's a lot of skill involved in it.
Sounds like the sort of game where you can be 3 hours in and you screw up.
Yep.
And you're kind of buggered.
And then you sit there for 5 hours being very annoyed. That's what invariably always happens to my friend Matt. He'll spend 20 minutes a turn choosing what he's going to do, and then as soon as he does it, he'll go, oh no. Which is very funny. But there's a whole series of them. They're called 18XX, because they're all set in the 1800s at some point. 61 is just my personal favourite, but there's all kinds of them. There's one set in the UK, one set in Spain, I think there's one in America, I forget, and they all have slightly different rules. But one of the interesting facts about this one is that originally, in the very early development stage, it was called 18ME and was set in Middle Earth. And it was supposed to be a fantasy version, which I always thought was quite good, because I imagined that I would totally call my train Mithrail.
So trains in Middle Earth, interesting.
I think that'd be great. You know, go from the Shire to Mordor. One does not simply ride into Mordor. But so 1861, a great game. But it's the best way of describing it really is a very advanced Ticket to Ride. It's if you took Ticket to Ride, made it far more complicated, and then added a stock market which basically wants to destroy you, then
How many players is it?
I think you can do it with two, but you really wouldn't because it'd be very difficult. Three is the minimum I've played with, and the maximum I think is six. I could be wrong on that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure 3 to 6.
Cool.
And yeah, I it says in the manual 6 hours, but from experience, it's more like, even with people who've played it before a lot of times, you'll still play it in 6 to 7. With people who haven't played before, it takes about 45 minutes just to explain what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then numerous points later on to say, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. And now you're not going to enjoy the rest of the day. Here, have a drink.
But you will enjoy 6 bottles of wine.
Yeah.
Sounds really cool. Like I say, the only thing that puts me off is having 8 or 9, or not having 8 or 9 hours to spare for a game. But I do love it when you can just get right into something like this.
That's true. I mean, I've not played it for a long time because the friends that I play it with, they play cricket in the summer, and now they've started playing golf in the winter. So actually nailing down a weekend when everyone is free is very difficult. I actually have in my calendar, I have a game. It's in my calendar as Ben playing his train game, 19th of March at 9 o'clock.
Nice.
So, and that's been in there for about a month and a half. So, I get unduly excited about playing this game. It's a fun day out for me, which says a lot, really.
Love it. But that sounds really cool, though.
So what about you? What games?
This is really hard for me, and there's still a couple that I really want to talk about. But I think I'm going to talk about a Euro game, because it's one of the games we've played quite frequently in the office. It nicely fits my, you can just drop in and play it without having to necessarily be there for the whole campaign, etc. And it's pretty damn good. I mean, I don't know... I worry it's a tiny bit overrated because everyone seems to love it. But the game I want to talk about is Terra Mystica. Now, Terra Mystica is, I think it's 2 to 5 players, but it's most fun with 4 or 5. I don't know if it would really work with 2. But, you know, I guess theoretically it does. But the idea is you each pick a fantasy race, and there's a hexagon-based board, and the idea is that you're kind of, I guess, inhabiting this planet, and you can terraform it as you go. So each race is quite different, which is one of the nice features. So they each have like a sort of land type which they prefer, or they need to have before they can build on it. So I might be like the weird desert creatures, and you might be halflings who like plains. And then there's a process, so you have a starting area, like one of the tiles, but there's a process for translating tiles into your area, but obviously it costs resources. Now the whole game plays out over, I think it's 6 turns, so it's sort of, you only ever get 6 turns, which means the game takes, I think it takes about 2 hours when we play, usually two and a half hours, maybe it's quicker.
That's only a 3-bottle-of-wine game.
Yes, unfortunately so.
I wouldn't be nearly drunk enough to play that.
There are lots of boxes of wine, Sweden. It's not trashy like the UK, when you say a box of wine. But you do get a large quantity in a box. So,
very quick tangent, but I saw the other day Sainsbury's is now selling little plastic glasses that have wine in them. And they have like a sealed top, like a juice box. And
I see those.
Just peel it off, and then you've got a little glass of wine ready to go. I think it's like taking to picnics and stuff.
Spencer's been selling those for years.
Yeah, that's... There's a whole new experience for me. I mean, I bought a shit ton of them, but... Now, wherever I am, I have a tiny little glass of wine.
I just... Next show, you have to tell me that it's in your cane.
They need to do one of those with a pint.
That's a very, very halfling thing to say. It comes in pints.
That's a massive cane you've got there. Well, slosh, slosh, slosh.
Another random tangent, I'm sorry to do this, but this is too good to pass up, is that there is a company that makes like fat suits for people. For men, it's like a beer belly, and for women, it's a larger bust. And it basically is empty, and you can fill it with booze, and it has a little straw that comes out of it. And it's designed so you can go to like football games or something, and you can just sit with a straw and basically drink whatever concoction you've put in your fat suit, and you just look like a fat person, but you're actually full of booze, which is amazing. I keep meaning to do it, but I just can't bring myself to go to a football game. So, right. Sorry, do go on about your game. Sorry.
If you're right playing a board game about trains wearing one of those suits. Yeah. But yeah, so
Terramystica.
I guess the aim of the game is to collect victory points, which is a little bit fluffy, but there are many different ways you can do it in it. It almost feels like a collection of simple mechanics put together, but when you bring them all together, the whole thing becomes quite complicated, but not because of the individual components. So at the beginning of each turn, you'll sort of collect your income, and then you'll get to take, you each take it in turns in kind of doing certain actions. And that might be to transform a piece, like terraform a piece of land, or build a dwelling on that land, which is a way that you can kind of... So each race has its own special ability, but they also have their own super special ability when you've built your final building, which is the big building. But it takes a lot of resources and a lot of setup to get that out. So the incentive to build is hopefully that you'll ultimately be able to build this kind of temple building, which will then give you your second ability, which will help you accrue more victory points quickly. So there's other reasons for building too, like you might then get more income on future turns, like you might get more money, more power, and more priests, so you can use your abilities. Then you can also send one of your priests off to kind of pray for a cult, which is another way of gathering victory points.
I don't think that's how cults are formed. I don't think they pray for cults. Please send me a cult.
Let's get together. It's like,
ding dong.
If you're the first to 10, then you get the most points. That's why cults exist, right?
Yeah, could be.
They want the victory points. Yeah. So yes, and then there's a whole bunch of like actions on the board that only one person can take each turn. So there's always this... do I want to do that action now? It's not really the right time, but if I don't do it, someone else might take the action off the board that I can't do it until the next turn. And then there's a whole different bunch of ways to sort of score victory points. So you might win on the cult board. You might have every turn you pick up a little token, which will give you a specific way of gaining victory points, but you can only hold on to it for one turn. So it might be, for every dwelling you build this turn, you get 2 more victory points. And you start to think, I want to do that. And then each overall turn, i.e. turn that all the players act in, will have its own special set of conditions too. So the conditions get mixed up between different games, but essentially there's a lot of resource management, there's a bit of worker placement, and then there's... But again, like 1861, there is nothing random in the game. I don't think at all. I mean, apart from the setup where you decide which tokens are in play and what the special effect is for each turn. But once the game is in motion, there is nothing random. So there's no like, I got screwed over by a dice roll. But yeah, that is Terramystica, and it's
nice.
Damn good.
I don't think I've played it. I think I've seen it, but I don't think I've played it. So I'll give it a try. How many people does it play?
2 to 5, but I would definitely suggest, I would suggest 3, 4, or 5. We've never played it with fewer than 3, but I think it'd be a bit of an experience.
A lot of games don't work with 2, I find.
No, I mean, I might be wrong, but it doesn't feel like it would work with 2. So, but it's very Eurogame-y, you know, like all the pieces are wooden. It's almost shiny. For a European game, it's actually pretty good looking, but the theme doesn't quite shine through enough for my... Like to look at it and go, that's a gorgeous game. It's not an FFG game where you want to put it on your shelf just because it looks gorgeous. But it certainly isn't the back. It's just a fairly, you know, nice but run-of-the-mill looking
nice
game. But yeah, that's Terra Mystica, and it's definitely worth a shot if you're into your sort of Euro gaming. So how about you, Chris? What's your pick of the board games?
It's interesting what you were just saying, because I look for a game that can be played with two, because obviously being parents with a young child, quite a lot of the time we are just in, you know, and sometimes we'll play a game when Alistair's in bed. And a game that I saw on Tabletop, Tabletop is like my gateway for most of these games, to be honest. It's a game that I saw on Tabletop and it looked good, and I popped down to our local game shop and they had it. And unlike a lot of these modern board games, it wasn't like £50 or £60, which is quite an upsetting thing about modern board gaming, I think. And it works really beautifully with two. And that game is Takenoko. And Takenoko is an interesting game. I watched the Tabletop episode a couple of times, not fully appreciating exactly what was going on. But
this is basically the one with the little pandas.
It is the one with the little panda, yeah. So nobody controls a particular piece. You basically got three different characters present in the game. You've got the Emperor of Japan, who you don't actually ever see, but you work on his behalf, and you have his gardener, and you have a giant Chinese panda that he was given by the Emperor of China as a gift. And basically, each of these three characters has a goal that they want to achieve. The Emperor of Japan wants to have a beautiful garden. The gardener wants to grow lots of bamboo for the beautiful garden. And the panda wants to eat all of the bamboo. So you basically play the game by deciding at any particular time who you're going to try and complete a goal for. And you just draw cards. So you could draw a card from the gardener card, and it will tell you a particular combination of bamboo that you need to grow. You can draw a panda card, it will tell you a particular combination of bamboo you need to eat. Draw an emperor card, and it tells you sort of a different garden layout. Now, you get these hexagonal tiles, which are in three different colours, and they just represent different parts of the garden. And it's a very gorgeous game, and it's very relaxing to play. And so you complete your goals by building the garden up and growing bamboo and then eating the bamboo. And you can be quite strategic, because you sometimes you've got limitations, like you can only grow four pieces of bamboo on a particular square. Some squares are fertilized, for example, so they will grow two pieces of bamboo in each turn that they grow bamboo. But maybe you have a card that requires you to grow three, in which case what you would need to do is you'd need to send a gardener to the tile to grow the bamboo, and then send a panda to the tile to eat a piece so that you bring it down from four to three. So there's room for nice little tactics there. Yeah, but it's a very sweet game, and it plays excellently with two people. But it can be played up to four.
How long does it take to play?
Between 30 and 60 minutes. It's fairly quick. I'd say with a two-player game, it's about 40 minutes probably. And then with a four-player game, it just takes a little bit longer. But it's basically the first person to complete 9 objectives. In a two-player game, 8 objectives in a three-player game, and 7 objectives in a four-player game. So it's got sort of a limit on how long you can play it for anyway.
Yeah.
But it's really good game, really lovely, and a lot of fun, a lot of replay value.
I actually saw it in a bookshop very recently, and I was this close to picking it up. Would you say it's the sort of game that a non-board gamer might play? Because I want to try
Wife. Yeah, because Sophie is not really a board gamer. We play Takenoko, and we play Ticket to Ride a lot. And I've got other games that she's not overly interested in playing. But Takenoko is a really good. In fact, the woman in the game shop that I bought it from, I mentioned, you know, to her, I'm looking for a game that my wife would enjoy. And she said, oh, yeah, it's definitely, it's the sort of game that you know your wife would enjoy playing with you.
Twister. Twister sweet. Yeah. If you want to get a divorce, 1861, I can tell you. You need a very, very patient woman in your life to put up with 9 hours of train.
Just a quick game of Russian trains, if you don't mind.
With a stock market twist.
You made me go to the opera last year.
I wish.
Well, that sounds really cool, though. Takenoko. I need to. I think I might actually, after the show, go and purchase that.
You'll enjoy it as well, I think. I think you would enjoy it.
It's one I've seen and keen to play as well, so I think you've convinced us. You win this round, Chris.
Yes. You win this
Dungeon
event.
Keeper 2 all over again.
Yep.
That would be a great board game, Dungeon Keeper 2.
I've been thinking about how you would board game that sort of thing, actually. I've actually written a bunch of notes down. So
you could do it like Warhammer Quest, where you're just drawing room tiles.
Mm. One character, one player would always have to be the announcer, though, whose job is purely just to pick up random cards and say things like, "It is payday."
Jackpot winner! <Yeah. laughs> That'd be awesome. But, right, now we could spend all night talking about board games, but I think it's a shame to only each talk about one, so maybe we can just whip through a few that we didn't choose as our one. And say what other things we are playing or would love to play at the moment.
Well, I have a couple. Citadels is one of my favourite games to play. That's an FFG, and you basically, every round, there are sort of a various different characters you can play as, like an architect or a wizard or so forth, and the aim is to basically build a city, and that's really fun. I won't go into the mechanics of it in too much detail, but Citadel's a really fun game to play with a small group of people. Lots of variety and fun to be had. And
primarily a card game, right?
Yeah, it's entirely a card game. Cool. But it's not a card game like a Magic or anything like that. It's set number of cards, but with different skills that you get, different classes of character that are there, and there's all kinds of different things that you can do in it. I generally just recommend that people search for it and look at it. Great game. And the other one is Carcassonne, which is a good one to play with non-gamers. That's a fun one, and again it's very European with the little wooden pieces that everyone looks at now. And quick mention to Ticket to Ride, as Chris mentioned, it's a great game. Really good sort of 1861 light, and Lord of the Rings.
Super, super light, I think.
Yeah. It's 1861 without the stock market, Russia, or any of the tedious gameplay. Lord of the Rings, the card game, is very good and a fun game that you can actually play by yourself if you're very lonely, which you obviously are if you've bought Lord of the Rings, the card game. And then the final one was a Game of Thrones, the board game. Which I had never read I had read, I think, about half of the first book of A Game of Thrones when I played it. But I hadn't seen the TV
series. About 9,000 pages, eh?
Yeah. So I'd read a bit of it. And then I started playing this game with two other guys. And to be honest, they were being dicks about it. They were like, "Oh, yeah, you won't win the first time you play it because it's very complex and there's a lot there. And obviously you don't know any of the stories. So it's going to be really difficult for you, blah, 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 blah." And I played as the Lannister family and I decisively won.
Right in your element there.
Yeah. Lannister's pretty much my wheelhouse. Let's be honest. Tywin. Oh, I love Tywin. I want to be Tywin. But that's for another day. Game of Thrones, great game as well, purely because I won. So, those are my picks.
Cool. How about you, Chris? Some other games on the table?
Yeah, like Ben, Ticket to Ride. Ticket to Ride Europe, actually, is my cup of tea. That was my first modern board game, and it's a game that I love to play a lot. I recently, like super recently, like at the weekend, played Betrayal at the House on the Hill, which was really good. That's like a game for 3 to 6 players, I think, where you are basically in this haunted house and you're drawing tiles basically off the top and building up the haunted house as you explore. Which was excellent. And then halfway through the game,
epic game.
But you've played it, yeah?
Oh, I love it. Great game.
Yeah, and like halfway through, you trigger an event. Like all the way through as you're playing, you're rolling dice to see if you trigger the event. And when you finally trigger it, one of the players suddenly turns into basically an evil cultist who secretly lured everyone else to the house to kill them. And it was excellent. I really enjoyed it. So like it's properly a game of two acts. Because suddenly like one of the characters was actually chasing the rest of us around the house with hellbats. It was mental.
And the really nice thing about that game is that there's like 50 different events that happen, the haunts they're called. And so there's a lot of variability. And then also one of my funniest facts about that game is that because you have the different tiles for the upstairs, middle, and downstairs, there was a printing error in the first batch of them that they did, which I've got a copy of somewhere, I think, where one of the upstairs tiles was Underground Lake.
Oh, nice.
So it's like you go into the attic and you find an underground lake.
Yeah, amazing.
great game. Really good choice.
And another game which is worth an honourable mention, John, you might either know this or like it, because I know you're a fan of the Formula One. It's a game called Formula D, and this is a great game. It's like the game board is the Monaco Grand Prix circuit, and you can play, I think, up to 10 players. And the way you basically just got to drive your car around the track, but the way you do it is by rolling a dice, which says how many squares you move. And as you start off with a four-sided dice, and you change gears, and as you change gears, you get bigger and bigger dice. So obviously you can go further when you're in turn, when you're in a higher gear. But then when you get to the corners, you need to slow down for the corners, otherwise you crash out. So you need to actually be changing your gears up and down and judging, you know, can I risk this on a 12-sided dice, or do I need to change gear and come down to an 8? Really, really fun game, Formula D. Quite complicated because you can do things like trash your wheels as you're going around corners and things. So, but yeah, fun. I like that.
That's pretty cool to hear a recommendation for that, because it's the sort of thing I can almost definitely convince Becky, my wife, to play, because she's a massive Formula One fan. So,
yeah, it's a lot of fun, actually. I've not played it with two. I've played it with four. So I don't know how well it would work as a two-player game, but certainly with four, it was great fun.
Cool.
I suppose you could have a couple of cars each.
Yeah. Not too long to play.
Yeah. No, it was maybe an hour. It was pretty good.
Cool. Right, I'm going to kind of whip through my honourable mentions. And then, so first up was a game, I've only played it once, and it was the sort of length of game that Ben would like, because you get many bottles of wine in. But it was called Twilight Struggle, and it's basically...
Anything to do with Twilight?
It's the Cold War.
Sounds preferable.
Yeah.
Yes, there's no sparkly vampires.
Would you rather be at detente with the Russians and their lovely railways, or would you be looking at sparkly vampires?
But what's interesting about Twilight Struggle is it is only a two-player game. And it goes through the phases of the Cold War from like 1945 to 1990 or whatever. It's more about the politics than the war, as it were. So you end up trying to decide where you're going to put your sort of supporters. And then there's a space racetrack and a whole bunch of other things that you can kind of invest into. A lot of the game is driven by cards as well. So you can... I'm trying to remember, it's a long time since I played, but it was a very good game, very, very deep, and but a lot of fun. So if you happen to just have 6 hours to spare, probably plus two more to learn it if you're buying it online, then it's actually a really, really good 1v1 game. Another game which is, this fits into the themed up, and I love the artwork sort of box, but this is called Rex, Final Days of an Empire, and it's basically Dune. Dune 2 sort of TV book and film, etc. They couldn't actually, I think they maybe made a Dune game, but didn't have the license to make another one, so it's kind of in spirit Dune, but not actually Dune. But it's a game which you can have up to five or six players, but each player has a completely different role in the... I guess it's like a special ability, but they're completely different. So, for instance, one race is in control of The board is like a massive set of provinces, like different areas, and you can move your guys around. And you can win the game in alliances, which there are official rules for. So you have to hold certain numbers of points to win the game. But if there's two in an alliance, you win the game together if you hold more points, but fewer together. So like you have to hold, I think, 3 out of 5 special zones to win on your own. But if you're an alliance of two, you have to hold 4 of them. But obviously you have 2 players. But yeah, so one player might have all the economy, and whenever you buy anything, the money actually goes to that player. And somebody else might hold all the influence. So whenever you sort of play special cards which pass influence around, it all goes to that certain player. And then another guy can basically have loads of troops for free because that's their thing. So it's a very, every person plays a part in the game's economy, but has their own very unique position to play, which makes alliances really important and powerful. But then you might backstab someone, and then there's a betrayal mechanic at the end. So you might win as a pair, but then there is like a last minute way of winning on your own. So you never quite know if you're going to be betrayed by someone. But it's really fun, but it's also a very long game. I think our first session took 6 hours with like 5 of us. But that's Rex, Final Days of Empire, and that's pretty cool. And then just 2 more that I'm going to whip through quickly. We've started playing the Pathfinder Adventure Card Game, which is an attempt, I guess, at having an RPG-like experience at the using cards. So we've been playing 6 adventures so far, and each one is played against a number of decks of cards. So basically you buy 500 cards when you buy the game. and then you set up decks at the beginning of a session, and you have to try and find the villain who is in one of the 5 decks, or his henchmen who are in the other decks. And you kind of take it in turns, go through these decks, have events happen to you, see if you can beat it together. But it's completely cooperative. You play against the board, and then if you win the quest, you might unlock a new skill, and you get to keep all the cool equipment you find. But it's kind of nice, because we want to do some RPG, I guess, ideally, but we don't have time. So we can play this in an hour and a half after work. We'll have a good laugh, get a bit of character progression, go through a story. Kind of fun. And that's the Pathfinder Adventure Card Game. And last but not least, I just mentioned Dust Tactics, which is I haven't played miniature board games since Warhammer when I was a kid. And some guys at work play a game called Dust, and it's I think it's basically if World War II never ended. So it's called futuristic, and the Germans have got all these zombies, and then all the Allied forces have got these mechs and things.
Because if the Germans had won, there would be zombies.
Pretty much, yeah. I think it's the Germans. I say zombies, I think they're like guerrillas. They trained up to fight.
It's Red Alert 2.
Yeah, I guess it's
sharks with lasers and stuff like that. Yeah. I'm sure they had like a squid in Red Alert 2 that you could like defuse bombs or something. Crazy game. Sorry.
No, it's spot on. It's definitely the sort of feel with this mechanized gorillas and things. It's just weird. and it's just fun. You can play a game in a couple of hours. You can play it light or heavy on the grid, or with a proper ruler and play with measurements. The figures are really nice. And it's quite a satisfying game to play. FFG, so it all looks gorgeous. And again, zombies and gorillas.
So what you want in a game, really?
What can go wrong? So one last thing to talk about before we wrap up the board games. And I know that we're all fairly avid users of our tablet. So I thought maybe it'd be worth just mentioning whether we play any board games on our tablet, especially if it's one of our favourites, it's Media Cross.
Yeah. I only play 2 board games on my iPad. In fact, that's a lie. I've played a few. I used to quite like Risk on the iPad because they had a single-player version, which was quite fun because I love Risk, but no one ever wants to play it with me.
it's so quick as well, the iPad one.
Yeah, it is.
It's a complete lie because you can play a full game of Risk in about half an hour.
Yeah, which is nice sometimes. I enjoy that like on a long plane flight or something. Just a little bit of Risk. Carcassonne is a brilliant transition from board game to iPad game. Really, really nice. Another one that I love to play on flights, especially long flights. And they've got AI versions, or they have you can play locally with someone else with the AI as well. So that's really nice, and they've got all the expansions on there as well, because Carcassonne has just so many expansion packs. Some of them are ridiculous when you start getting to like dragons and like portals and stuff.
Yeah, nice. It's
bizarre the amount of stuff they have in Carcassonne, but that's a beautifully made rendition, probably the best board game to iPad transition I've seen. And then Ticket to Ride is again a very, very good board game transition. I've not actually tried it recently. I think it would be much better on the iPad Pro than it was on the iPad.
It's recently had a massive update, so they might they might have made it more compatible. I'm not sure.
Even just having the extra pixels just to spread out the map a bit, just because it is just a little bit too small, I find, on the iPad screen. But again, that's a very, very good transition, how they've done that. I think they've got AI in there as well, or you can play locally with someone. Good, quick games. I wouldn't want to play anything too complicated on an iPad. But similarly, there are simple games like Exploding Kittens has just come out with an iOS game, which is only for iPhone, and it's only local player. And I'm like, I wouldn't bother with that. And like, Flux has an iPhone app, and it's like, you know, I'd rather just play with the cards because they're the same size. What I want in an iPad game is something big like Ticket to Ride or Carcassonne that you can't take on a plane. A game of Flux or Exploding Kittens I can take with me in a bag, but I'm not going to bust out Ticket to Ride on the middle of a flight. So, those would be my two picks. One that I would love to see, just because the bit that takes so long in 1861 is at the end, when you've got so much track laid and you're trying to work out the most efficient way to get from one point to another and make the most money. And people will help you. You'll be there and everyone will be trying to work out for you what's the most amount of money to make, because that's sort of like one of the rules of the game, is that you should always help other people in like their decisions and so on. Is I always thought how cool it'd be to have a Microsoft Surface, like the original Surface, like the table.
Yeah.
And have like the hexagonal tiles with RFID chips so that it could know the route, so that you could literally just go, what's the best route? And it would go, bloodum. There you go. Because to be honest, 4 hours of 1861 is that part. And at that part, after I have finished a bottle and a half of wine, I am ready to go to sleep. So that is the worst part, because I don't care for the difference in 10 rubles, but other people do. But yeah, Ticket to Ride and Carcassonne for iPad for me.
I like playing board games on the iPad, but something about it doesn't always work.
The issue that I have with it is very much like reading magazines on an iPad, in that they tend to be very quick, cheap ports. And to be honest, I would rather play iPad games on my iPad, or, you know, video games that are optimized for touch, and things like Faster Than Light or Alter's Adventure or something like that, a mobile game, rather than trying to force a board game into an iPad. Because whilst that is useful sometimes, a lot of the time the reason I like board games is because they're physical, in the same way that I like to read physical books or physical magazines. And I don't think a lot of them have got that right.
No, I think a lot of the... I like the fact that they can make the games go very quick. I like the fact you can... I think the time I most often play a board game on my iPad is when I've played something in real life and I kind of want to play it more. Because it feels like the perfect platform for digital versions of board games. But yeah, something... I'm not that drawn to playing them on there. But that said, it's the only place that I've played Ticket to Ride so far, which I really like, but I want to play it in real life. But I've got a copy, but haven't convinced anyone to play it yet.
I'll play it with you.
Maybe we can set up the game online.
We need to go to Sweden, Chris. Definitely. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Or you guys can play it on Steam. You can play it on Steam, I think.
Cool.
Or you just get on a flight in. I'll provide the alcohol. And the board games.
Ironically, the alcohol in Sweden is more expensive than the flight to Sweden.
Yeah.
Especially if I'm going.
But it will be limitless. But yeah, so Ticket to Ride's actually quite a good game to play on my iPad, as well as Carcassonne and Settlers of Catan, because they're, you know, classics. One game I think I want to really just mention, and it's a really cool board game. Played it 2 or 3 years ago, so it's a bit fuzzy in my head. But I remember picking up the iPad app afterwards, and it's called Eclipse. New Dawn for the Galaxy, and it's kind of a 4X game set in space. You know, you explore and expand and then exterminate at the end, where you explore these tiles and things. But the iPad rendition is superb. You can tell they put a lot of effort in, and it really shows. And I think while I first played it on the tabletop and then played it on iPad afterwards, I think you can probably learn the game from the iPad, which is a rare thing.
I have an honourable mention for Seven Wonders as well, which is a board game I don't actually like, but the iPad transition was very good. And one of the nice touches they added was an extra wonder of the world, which was the Apple, the new campus, the spaceship-style circular one. And that was 4 years ago when they bought that to iPad and they did it based on the mock-ups. I thought that was pretty cool, but I don't like Seven Wonders as a game. But it probably deserves an honourable mention.
You just reminded me somehow of the one last game that I need to mention, and that is Warhammer Quest on the iPad.
Yeah, that's so good.
While Radio Games trying to make too much money out of it by selling all the characters separately, just buy the core pack and play it through with the four base characters. It's really good.
That game is excellent on the iPad. You know what else is really good on iPad? Apart from Ticket to Ride, which you've all mentioned, which is amazing, but is Pandemic. Which is a game that I would love to play the board game edition, but A, I don't think it would work as a two-player game, and B, I'm not entirely sure my wife would enjoy it. It's very complicated. The iPad version is really good. I've been looking for one for ages, which is how I came across Plague Inc., which is a totally different box.
Yes.
Get the fish.
Yeah, I love
Plague Inc. But then finally, there is an iPad version of Pandemic now, and it's really good. I'm aware that we've been chugging on for a while, so just briefly mention there are a couple of games which I do play on my iPad. I play Small World on my iPad, which is kind of good. I'm not sure how well it ports to iPad. I haven't played it physically.
The physical game is better of Small World. Again, I should imagine. I think it's a size issue more than anything.
Yes.
The map is quite big.
Yes.
Might be better on the iPad Pro.
And I have to say, I really like playing Magic the Gathering on the iPad as well. Really enjoy that.
Yeah.
Although the latest version doesn't work on my iPad or my iPhone, so that's how well they think of me as a customer.
That's what you get for updating through iTunes.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. So I think we have hit board games pretty well and truly hard this evening. So if you like the show, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. We'll make a special exception this week. Feel free to leave a review in any language that we can Google Translate back to English. Check out other episodes by going to thedivide.co.uk and obviously follow us on Twitter to hear when new episodes come out at Podcast Divide. So the next show will be on the 16th of March. And thank you ever so much for listening.
Smashing. Cheers. Go and watch Deadpool.